Good morning. I'm happy to be here with you, a little belatedly entering Sishin. I was on the East Coast. The primary purpose was to be doing some work with exiled Burmese monks, and that happened, and that was really, it just felt good. It was very useful and wonderful to be with them. And I did a few other things while I was there, a couple of readings and talks, and also got to visit with Sylvie in Connecticut. I think Sojin recruited me because he's in the kitchen today. So I think we can expect the beans. Between Sojin and Paul, we can expect the beans to be very good. I left, flew out last Wednesday morning, and the evening before, our good friend Rebecca Maino passed away at her daughter's home in Berkeley. And I know you had a ceremony on Sunday evening, is that right?
Yeah.
And maybe some of you were at the cremation ceremony at Pacific Interment. So this has been on my mind for the last 3 weeks. And I thought, if it's okay, I'll talk a little about Rebecca and the process of her dying and how it feels to me. I think I'll start with a poem by a 14th century Zen master, Kozan Ichikyo, who died in 1360. At just about Rebecca's age, Rebecca was 78, and Kozan was 77. And this was his death poem. Empty-handed, I entered the world. Barefoot, I leave it. My coming, my going, two simple happenings that got entangled. Read that again. Empty-handed, I entered the world. Barefoot, I leave it. My coming, my going, two simple happenings that got entangled. So Rebecca, just some basics. Her Dharma name was Daishin Mitsuzen, which means great or magnanimous mind, and intimate Zen. She was a priest here at Berkeley Zen Center. She was ordained in year 2000, I believe, with Raul and David Lundberg, the three of you guys together. She began to practice the Dwight Way in the late 60s, and then was involved in raising her family. She had five children, and until recently, I couldn't keep them straight. But after the last 2 weeks, I could see them all quite vividly. She had a son, Jan, and who lives up Mendocino County, and then four daughters who are all around here, Sarah, Lauren, Amiko, and Reiko. And then they have a lot of, I think all of them have children. Yeah. So there's a gaggle of grandchildren who are quite wonderful, really, really wonderful to be around. And they were all around in these last couple of weeks. Rebecca was born in 1932. She was married to Arthur Maino, who some of you may have met, one of the quietest human beings on the planet. Yet, always warm, always inclusive, and his, you know, his outward demeanor was so quiet, but he was, he's a terrific artist, and his art is very loud. You know, it's like really out there and colorful and bright and expressive, and really a wonderful artist, and that's what he's been doing all his life, making art, working with his hands. He built a house for one of his daughters behind another daughter's house and built it all by hand. So they had a wonderful marriage. As I said, she began here in the 1960s and then took a break, I think, to raise her family, and then returned after a while, after some hiatus, in just about the time that I started coming here in the early 1980s. And she just was the kind of person that, this rare kind of person that when you meet them, you feel like they've decided they're going to be your friend, irrespective of what you think or you intend. And, you know, Mary, Lucy wrote something that I think she sent out to the PC, the practice committee list, that there's a way in which, at least I felt, that she was mothering many of us. She was just inclusive, and she had that, you know, the body of the Prajaparamita that she made up here on the altar somewhat resembles hers, somewhat voluptuous and embracing and encompassing, and that's the way her spirit was, and that's the way her spirit is. She was really an exemplar, initially an exemplar of lay practice, and she was the third Shuso, or head student, that we had here, and that was in July, late June, early July of 1991, and she was a Shuso after Maile Scott and Fran Tribe, you know, they did the Shuso ceremony in a kind of proper way, you know, just really speaking in a very very condensed, brief manner, addressing everyone who asked the question, which is the way you're, quote, supposed to do it. And Rebecca's was the longest Shuso ceremony in history. It just went on and on. And some of you were there. But it's because it was just an energy. She wasn't going to give this Zen response. She had a conversation with everybody. Each person who asked a question, she had a conversation, you know, and it was really wonderful. The whole room was just alight with her warm energy. And then, as I said later, she really felt when her children were pretty much grown, and she had ended her teaching career. She was an elementary school teacher. She wanted to ordain as a priest. That's what she wanted to do with the rest of her life, and that was in 2000. And she did that. I'm sorry, it occurred to me, I was thinking of the various people that I have sat with here as they were dying, and I realized it's like not a good gig for longevity to be a priest at this temple. this is my dark sense of humor, I'm afraid. But she continued. She taught sewing, and so so many of us have sewed with her and worked on our boxes and robes. And she did periodic classes in Buddha making, and as in that last section of her life, she had been a potter all the time and made cups that we used for years for tea, and made them for San Francisco Zen Center and other places. But she really got taken with making these images, basically Jizos and Bodhisattva and Pragyaparamitas. We had spent a long time meetings, haggling back and forth about the lack of feminine images in the Zendo, which is a real lack. And like, what's the right one? Where do we get one? What do we do? And then it's like that showed up. She just decided in the midst of all this, she realized she could do that, and she began making these. And they were, you'll find them, her Prajnaparamitas and also her large, the Jizo she made is back in the Jizo garden, which is very lovely. And this was her work. This is what she did each day. She worked back in her studio behind the house and made these images. So these are kind of facts. At a certain point, she was having trouble with memory, and I can't remember how this happened, but I was with the family when we went to Stanford, and she got the diagnosis that she had in early stages of Alzheimer's, and it really was like for everybody, like just getting punched in the gut. There was not a lot that you could do. There was some medication you could take. But for my sense of time blurs, but I suspect that was in the early part of the 2000s. Must have been like 2001 or something like that, 2002 at the latest, or 3. But for a number of years, she came to Zazen. She was slowly retreating in her interactivity, but she came to Zazen and sat in a chair and put on her robes, and it was a really intimate, I mean, her name was Intimate Zen, and for me it was a very intimate experience, because I was sitting across from her, and I just felt like we were trying to take care of each other. And then there came a time when it just got too difficult for her to make it, but in that period before, a number of us, we would pick her up in the morning at her house, and that was all always very sweet. Wasn't a lot of talk, but there was a sweetness to the interaction, and she was comfortable, and we were comfortable with her, but there was a grief and a sadness in watching her slowly retreat from what seemed like the present. Of course, we don't know what was actually taking place. I do remember, this is long before she had this diagnosis, she was talking about her mother, and I guess her mother had had Alzheimer's, and she was talking about an encounter that she had had late in her mother's life when she went to the facility. And her mother said something like, "I don't know who you are, dear, but there's something very sweet about you that I like. Which was, you know, it was very powerful when she said it, and then of course even more powerful when that was what was happening. So a number of people from here visited her over the years, both in their home, and then she was moved to a facility on Elm Street in El Cerrito. And interactions were limited, but there was definitely responsiveness. Response. She would eat and she would watch, particularly like to look at images or look at photographs, and her room was, there were photographs all over her room of people who were close to her in her life. And pictures on the altar. And I think I had visited her not so long before, I think just about a couple weeks. And then there was a call on November 16th that reportedly, Rebecca had 24 to 48 hours to live. And so we went over there, a couple of us, Lori and I went over there and chanted with her. And then that night, there was another call that the facility, I guess her daughter Lauren had stayed with her the night before, and she had stopped taking food and drink. And was not really able to swallow for some mysterious reason, but Lauren had spent the night, and the next day the people at this facility said, nobody can stay here after 7 o'clock. And you know, the family was shocked. Hospice was shocked, the Kaiser Hospice, and you know, everybody felt, well, no, this is not okay. But also, it was kind of freaky. I mean, because, okay, so what are we going to do? We're not going to leave. No, we weren't going to leave her there. But the thought of moving her in this fragile condition was daunting. But that's what they ended up doing. Hospice was really good. They arranged for an ambulance, and the guys that came were really skilled and just very kind with her. And they got a bed delivered to her daughter Sarah's house, which was all set up. And Lori and I rushed over and got all the altar stuff. And so by the time she got to Sarah's house, the whole environment had been sort of recreated. Contrary to expectations, this 24 to 48 hours stretched out to 2 weeks. Which I gather from talking to Andrea and others is kind of unusual. But I think it had something to do with how comfortable it was there. How she was surrounded by love, and really there was nothing that she needed to do. And the quality of love that surrounded her at the same time as the quality of ordinary life, which I think was a mark of Rebecca's practice, just to be able to really thrive and glow and grow in the midst of family, hustle and bustle, work. And so she was just in the middle of it all. So it sort of was another one of those life lessons in not knowing what's a good thing and what's a bad thing. You know, looked like really, you know, how could they do this? You know, not let anybody stay there. You know, just really seemed wrong. And if we had gotten caught in our anxiety, she probably would have died within 24 or 48 hours, maybe. Who knows? But everybody, including Rebecca, did what they had to do to make the move. And then that was really a good thing. So there are a number of the family. There were a lot of people who visited Rebecca. The family was most acquainted with just a small group of people: Sojourn, Ross, Andrea, Lori, myself, and Peter Overton's sister Anne. And so we were there most days over the 2 weeks, sitting with her, and then towards the end set up a schedule to help the family, because they were exhausted. They had not expected such a long haul and really needed help just to have someone present. And so we had shifts. I was really thinking a lot also of the Case 55 and the Blue Cliff record, which I've talked about, Sogan's talked about, other people have, Dao Wu's condolence call, where a student, Yuan Wu and Qingyuan and Dao Wu go to visit a family where a person has died, and Qingyuan knocks on the coffin and wants to know, alive or dead? And I won't go into the whole koan, but I thought of that a lot, because over the course of the 2 weeks, it seemed to me physically Rebecca was diminished and diminishing, and there was some, you know, initially some responsiveness and some seemed like eye contact and tracking, and less of that. And also, since she wasn't getting food or water, she was physically changing. But what it seemed like, and this is just my subjective view, there was something like her skin became very smooth, and it's a kind of sweet expression often on her face. And in the last days, last 2 days, it just seemed like the line between being alive and not being alive was so close. And yet, she was decidedly alive. You know, in some sense, fully functioning human organism. And yet so close to this line. And then, what is this line? What is it for her? What is it for us? There didn't seem to be a lot of distress. Her breathing was, for the most part, pretty easy, slow, shallow, but her eyes were either closed or then later had, you know, this kind of faraway look. Was alive or dead. But in that in those moments, coming down on the side of life. And I kept thinking, who is Rebecca? Where is she? Because she was there. And after returning, the night that she died, I was playing at Ashkenaz, and I got a call from Lori, and so I came after the show, and wonderful. Just incredible energy to walk into, because the women were all gathered around Rebecca, was her daughters and Lori and Andrea and I think Anne. Yeah, Anne and the two granddaughters dressed in white who looked quite angelic. And everyone was lovingly, they had washed her body. They dressed it in, initially in the kimono, and then they shaved her head, and then put her in her robes, which was not so easy. Actually, it did pretty good. It was easier than we thought, maybe. Looking at Rebecca, I saw, oh, there is a real difference. So now, alive or dead was coming down on the other side. And yet, the whole room was touched, filled with a sort of formless presence. And I couldn't help thinking, and I had been thinking about this for several days, that the last thing that she did was this amazing pulling together, merging of her family, her biological family and her Zen family, which I think there had been perceptions at different points by each side of those family vectors leading in. There's some tension there, pulling in one way or another. But we had spent a long time, 2 weeks, working together, and it really, the feeling was very, very intimate. And then finally all the work was done, and Sojin Roshi organized a very small, intimate service where we chanted the Heart Sutra and circumambulated, and then people got a chance to speak in that moment. And when you do this, you set up an altar, just as at the cremation ceremony. You set up the altar, but there's no Buddha image on the altar because the body there is the Buddha. And that's really the feeling that there was in the room. So people spoke briefly, but with tears, with joy and appreciation. That was the first of what will be a succession of goodbyes. There will be a large memorial which will be open, I believe, in late January. We're sort of working on this now. But this question, alive or dead, lingers. Rebecca is here in many of our hearts. Not everyone knew her, but a lot of people did. And some of us knew her in her prime. Some of us knew her later. But her hand and her spirit are also in this place and with all of us. So I think I'm going to stop there. There's probably more I could say, but I want to leave time for people to speak or say whatever you would like to. And we're going to, as I said, in each of our rituals of goodbye, there's opportunity to do this. That's what we do. We have some little time here.
I wanted to mention that a number of years ago we had a ceremony for Rebecca.
Yeah.
And we all lined up and expressed to her how we felt about her and how we appreciated her while she was still able to receive that, and she had a wonderful time.
Yeah, it was 2005. I looked this up. Yeah,
2005.
Yeah.
It'd be nice to have that book.
There is a... Yeah, I don't...
have it at home.
There's a it's in the community library.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
So there was a sort of a book of remembrances, right?
Yeah.
I, you know, I have a copy that somebody has in Oregon. I can scan it.
We have a copy in the library, and we can bring it out and set it on the counter by the bulletin board after the lecture, and people can look through it.
That's a good, that's a great idea.
I just looked at it a, you know, a few... Yeah. Nights ago when this came up, so I know it's in there.
I know that's a great idea if you can do that. Scanning it also might be
well,
good.
I think Ross has the whole thing and can generate more copies if people want that.
Right.
I think it says in the book what you can do to get more copies.
Alan, I just want to thank you a lot for talking about Rebecca. I was kind of longing for that, I think, because we did celebrate, I mean, we did a memorial, but we didn't have words.
Mm-hmm.
But along those lines, you know, my coming here, Rebecca's going from here, got entangled. I mean, I started coming here, I think it was 04, and she was already, you know, in decline and being escorted, you know, 2000 in the mornings. And I have this really great memory of one of my first Shoshan ceremonies. And she came to the end of the mat, and she did like a, she just turned and did a circle and looked at each of us around the Zendo.
Yes.
Mm.
And then she got back to facing Sojin. I think there was one word maybe, like, just, you know, this or something. I don't know what she said. There was some word that's gone out. But, and then bowed. And it was, I was so touched. And I still remember it.
Mm.
And I didn't know this woman at all, but she really did have that kind of extending warmth. You know, the mothering that you talked about, you know, that resonates. I really feel that's true of her. So, thank you very much for sharing.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan, for your talk. I was one who didn't know Rebecca very well. And I have this thought about her death. And perhaps the length of time that it took her to die gave the two sides of her family, the Zen side and the biological side, a chance to come together. And there's something, the beauty of what she represented as far as service.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to share that thought.
Thank you. Sue?
Thank you. A lot of memories. I was at her Shoshan ceremony. I guess it was the first the Shinites had. It was pretty close to her. And I was very new, pretty new then. And I said, do you think that I could be a Zen student? Because I wasn't sure. And she said, with this gigantic beam on her smile, she said, with absolute confidence, oh, yes. And, you know, it's like welcome. And if you went to her house, it would be likely you'd get dinner, you know. I felt indebted to her because I felt a little bit in awe that, you know, I think I have this shy part of me and I never invited them over, you know.
Mm.
Like she fed me. Yeah.
Thank you. Peter?
Well, special thank you, Simon, for me, because I only knew this sort of ghost-like character who would show up here early mornings with being accompanied, and it was obvious that she was both venerated and also past your prime, for sure. And your talk today, really, in the same way as the figures that she made, have form. Now she has a form for me. And I've, you know, there's been a lot of talk, Rebecca this, Rebecca that, over the last couple of weeks here. But this talk really, I think I have a sense of knowing her now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just, again, this is my own awareness. I want to be careful about not sanctifying her.
No.
And if ever there was a person, she was very. But to me, what she exemplified was the wondrous quality of ordinariness. You know, just really doing all that. You know, not a saint, a physical, you know, a voluptuous, big-breasted, chunky, heart-filled person, and going at life and making mistakes, but full-hearted. So, you know, we don't want to get too rarefied. That's all. John.
Yeah, one of the things that has been really very powerful for me through this whole process and her dying and also being at the cremation ceremony is, you know, the span of time that I've known her when she was, you know, before she really started to decline, and these various qualities. And there's a whole range of experiences that I've had with her, which she could be wonderful, she could be, you know, a bitch. And then when she started declining, and I just very vividly recall the times in which she started to get very agitated in the zendo. And it was a very, very difficult and painful process that we went through as far as, you know, her not coming anymore.
Yeah.
And there's a tremendous feeling of loss in that. And but what it really kind of struck me in the ceremony was that here is this one person encompassing this whole mix of things. An extraordinarily warm, helpful person. She rescued my Jukai with my envelope for my rocks, which was just absolutely flummoxed me. And there was this wonderful feeling. And then at the same time, I have these feelings like that, and then the being with her when she's just extremely agitated and kind of, you know, just, you know, what am I going to do? And there's some times when I brought her here and I, you know, okay, I'm taking her home, and how's that going to be? And then as she became fairly demented, and Ross and I would go have lunch with her and Arthur, and there'd be this sweetness, a lot of it, and mellowness, maybe a lot of it also having to do with medications that she was taking, but there's this sweetness. So it's this mix of sweetness, wonderful lovingness, times irritability, agitation, and all together in this one package, and just looking at her and realize this is all mixed around in there. It was a wonderful experience, to kind of experiencing life in totality.
Yeah, well, that's the way we are. Each of us. Yeah.
I'm wondering, the person who is in the process of dying, are they the same as the person who is alive? Because I know, like, I've seen people die, and they're very, very different people as they're dying.
I think everyone does it. Everyone manifests in their own unique way. That is embedded in that koan, so you should work on it. that's part of what that koan is really bringing forth, even within life, alive or dead.
Yeah. I had some interactions with Rebecca, I think, while she was in sort of an intermediate state. And I was struck by her expressing herself without language. Like once I was driving her home and we got to the stoplight on Dwight Way. I mean, not to them, but she said, wonderful people, such wonderful people, such good times. Well, you know, I knew exactly what she was talking about, and she knew that I knew what she was talking about. But I think also there's the whole koan of our practice, because we would like to think that somehow a sincere, devoted practitioner would somehow have some kind of immunity from what happens in your mind. I mean, you're laughing, but
we'd like to think.
You can kind of understand that the body not, but you kind of, you know, to see her become agitated and to become withdrawn and to so much, become unfamiliar. I mean, I think Matt's question is very poignant because it was an extraordinarily powerful teaching to see that and to realize whatever we think we're doing here, it's not, you know, it's in some ways it can't save you from certain kinds of things. I think, you know, especially that it was a mind thing, that it was her mind and her spirit that kind of really changed.
Thank you. Andrea?
Following up a little bit on both of those last points, I found Rebecca's dying an amazing teaching, actually. Rebecca went for 16 days without food and water, which is an incredibly long time for someone who is already as debilitated as she was. You know, the family home was really beautiful, and it was warm, and there were candles, and chanting was playing, and the fireplace was going, and Rebecca was lingering on and on, and the family started to get a little impatient. They were making it too nice for her. They stopped the fireplace going, and they got a little bit
colder. One day they went away.
Well, maybe there's some. What's her unfinished business? What's she waiting for? The sun hadn't been down for Mendocino yet, and they were all expecting that after he came, she would immediately die. And days went on, and then they thought we're around too much, and we're making this loving, warm, familial household. So we're going to go during the day and just leave the house empty with the people who, you know, extended family that she was connected with. Or we'll have other people come, and still she lingered. And it was amazing to go and be with her every day and see her slowly go through the stages of disconnecting from this life. The stages of at times being so alert during the chanting and so responsive to it. Her granddaughters would come and stroke her hair, and you know, this is 10 days without food and water, and she would pucker to kiss them, and finger her more, and you could tell that she was, you know, this is some projection, because who knows, but she was using her hands, still her beautiful sculptor's hands, and she would move them around. And then it seemed like she turned more and more inward as the process went. And in the last two or three days, there was barely any outward connection. And then just the slowness of her breathing the last day or so, where you knew that any breath could be the last breath. Not because it was irregular like you've known sometimes people have, but just because her dying was that peaceful. And it likened, I thought about a flower on the winter branch, just slowly, slowly, slowly withering, waiting for the last breeze that will blow it off. And Rebecca's passing was really that gentle and that complete. And I thought some of that maybe was the Alzheimer's, but I actually think it was a manifestation of her practice, that nothing was in the way and her body could just go through this natural unfolding in a way that's really pretty unusual. I mean, it happens, but it's pretty unusual.
Time for maybe one or two more. Bob?
A lot of people know the image on the altar is was made by Rebecca, but I think a lot might not know. Om, maybe about 8 years ago, could you hold up the striker with the bell?
Oh, yeah.
The large one. Sojin asked her, it had gotten worn, and Sojin had asked her to repair it. And that's made out of many, many thin layers, each of which has to be layered on and glued and set. And I remember Rebecca complaining to me how much work it was. but she did it, and she did a beautiful job. And when you hear the bell now, you'll hear some of Rebecca through its voice.
Thank you. One more? Yeah.
You know, we thank you for your talk very much. It's very moving. We chant the ancestors in the morning, and I always wonder, who are they? Mm-hmm. So it's not to sanctify, but to know.
Mm-hmm.
And to know, you know, whose shoulders we stand on. And it's, it feels so intimate to know something about Suzuki that we talked about last night.
Thank you. I'm going to close by just, I'd like to read that poem one more time and then we'll end. Empty-handed I entered the world, barefoot I leave it. My coming, my going, two simple happenings that got entangled. So, thank you very much.